Journey Church is a community and movement, a fellowship of discovery. We desire to love well and serve often, while together we explore the adventurous love story of Jesus.
Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Morning indeed. We three kings. Kings. Okay, so here's the truth. We weren't kings. Spoiler alert. Wise men. That's closer. Yeah, we were wise men. That's the reason we had the gig. I mean, that's what we did. We gave wisdom, we gave advice, we studied all sorts of stuff to be able to do it, stars, science. We knew all the prophecies and the parchments. We passed it along. We were part of a long history, a tribe of these wise people. Another thing, there was more than three of us on that trip. I guess three is kind of compact in the nativity picture. 12 to 15 would be a bit over the top. Sometimes it might take that many, though, to keep the others from fighting over the baby Jesus. But there was more. Three, we had three gifts, and we three kings of Orient. Orient makes you think of Asia, but actually we were from kind of Persia, Middle East, Iran. And we, as I said, we studied parchments, we knew about prophecies, we knew about the Jewish prophecies about this Messiah, because hundreds and hundreds of years ago, we had Jews that were caught and lived in Babylon. We'd heard these prophecies. So when this opportunity came to see this star, I got chosen. I was pretty happy. A bit of validating. So we traveled, and listen, maybe you're someone that is visiting here and it's Christmas, you know, it's visit the Christians time of year, I don't know. Okay, heckled by a child. Not even the wise are protected. But seriously, maybe that's why you're here, and just so you know, I relate with that because I'm not Jewish. None of us were, and we were included in this story somehow. So just so you know, I'm with you. I'm an outsider that kind of found my way on the inside. But just to cut the story short, what happened was we went to Jerusalem, we followed this star. It was so bright that we could see it from where we were. And we inquired, and we met this guy called Herod. He was the king of the Jews. Dodgy guy, okay? Dodgy. Great politician, though. He asked us all about this king of the Jews. Where's he going to be so I can worship him? You don't have to be a wise man to know that not every king goes, oh yeah, tell me where the other king is. I want to meet him. No. We found ourselves in Bethlehem. It was impossible to miss the place. It was like lit up. The Jews referred to it as Shekinah glory. We knew about stuff like that too. And we went in there and we met this small child, and it was quite a scene. But I want to tell you a few things that are humbling to tell you, that are more about my personal side of the journey. Because you see, I was one of the guys, I was one of the wise men. I'd done my training, I knew all my stuff. I hadn't really say this, because back in those days I probably didn't even really realize it. But even though I was with the in crowd, because when we turned up in Jerusalem and also it was a scene. We were like traveling with a serious posse. And we looked amazing. You know, like we sort of had to look like the guys, the wizards out of Harry Potter. You've seen them. I mean, it was hard to pass us up. And yet the truth is I always felt like I was kind of an imposter deep down. I didn't really tell anyone, but I always thought someone was going to find me out, because deep underneath what I did was this, it was like this sadness, this feeling like I never really fit in. This feeling like, well, everyone else is okay, but I'm not. And I couldn't shake the feeling that somehow something was going to change when I met this child. I can't explain it. See, that's the problem. When you work with science and studying things, when you get something emotional, it's hard to trust it. Especially when you think, yeah, when I meet this little infant, my whole life's going to change. Doesn't sound like the wisest thing you could say, but I just had a gut feeling. As we got closer and closer, I had that war in myself where I thought, I can just keep going the way I am, I'm fine. And the other side going, dude, you're a mess. You're a mess. You're broken. And I just didn't have peace. I just didn't. I felt like there was this war. I was like a hurricane inside me. And I couldn't keep it quiet anymore. And all I can say is this: when I saw that child, I really believed that this is the Messiah. This is the game changer. This is God here. It's kind of crazy, right? It's a crazy story. You wouldn't have made it up if you wanted to start a religion. But the good news is that even people like me, not only an outsider in terms of my nationality, but feeling like a total outsider in terms of God liking me or thinking that he could give me a big hug in my soul. I didn't think that. And yet, this place. So maybe like me, this Jesus character could be what you're looking for. Could be. So maybe you might see him differently this Christmas.
Well, my name is Jamie. I'm one of the pastors here, and I get to continue on as we consider the Christmas story and these interesting set of characters that were there. I'm going to pick up reading in Matthew chapter 2. Paul has set us up well in the story of the Magi, but here it is from Matthew's narrative in the New Testament, Matthew 2, verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews?" Now, think about that phrase for a second. They've arrived in Jerusalem where they're about to interact with the current reigning king, who, by the way, is not Jewish. So he's really an illegitimate king. He's an Edomite who is placed there for political reasons by the Roman Empire. So when we hear about Herod in a minute, you'll understand his insecurity. So the question is, hey, where is the one who's born king of the Jews? We saw his star in the east, and we've come to worship him. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, as you might imagine. And all Jerusalem with him. Well, Jerusalem with him, everyone else was disturbed because King Herod had a reputation. He was so jealous, he was so threatened, that if anyone, if there was just the least bit of suspicion, he'd have them murdered. This included his mother, two of his sons, close friends. He just murdered people. As a matter of fact, when he died, he knew he was sick. He knew he was going to die. He said, "On the day I die, make sure you round up about 10 of the city's favorite people and murder them, because I want to make sure there are people crying on the day that I die." This guy had some issues. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. In Bethlehem, in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written, and then they quote this prophecy. "But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." And Paul so eloquently identified, kings don't go find other kings to bow down and worship them. Verse 9. After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. Now, again, to dispel another myth of the nativity, the wise men arrived probably not in the cave, not the night of his birth, but probably after Jesus was anywhere between 1 and 2 years old. We know this because Herod had everyone 2 years old and younger murdered. So as Jesus is a child, they arrive, and when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. And they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. I think the Magi in this story offer us some interesting perspective. And before I climb into that, I want to highlight one more aspect about them that I think is important, because there is a pretty practical application for us and a reminder that each one of us has a life that matters. These Magi essentially became the first investors in Christianity. They were the first people to offer a financial gift to the kingdom. These wise men carried this story with them to find Jesus, and of course would have carried the story back. These men display for us something that's quite unique and powerful, and they helped Joseph and Mary, who were going to have to leave. They were going to be refugees. It actually empowered them with some resources to flee to Africa to live there, then return to Nazareth and start a carpentry business. So in many ways, they truly were investors to help the young family as they fled, because Herod was about to murder all the children in Bethlehem, and then return. But what about these wise men? How did they know this story? Why were they so compelled to research science, to come and discover who this king was, and then to respond in this way? Well, we actually have to go back to the book of Daniel to understand a little bit about them. Now, perhaps if you've grown up in the church, you know a little bit about Daniel. Daniel's famous for a couple things, but probably the thing he's most famous for is being thrown into a lion's den and surviving. Daniel was a part of a group of people that were captured by the Babylonians. The whole nation of Israel was captured, and they took some of the best and the brightest, and they trained them. And eventually, these best and the brightest, there were some other people, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, perhaps you heard of them, they were thrown into a fire pit and didn't burn. So there's a theme here. And these young men were trained by an opposing government, but they wanted to raise up some of the people that they brought into captivity for their perspective, for their cultural heritage. And so some of the nations that they conquered, the Babylonians and then the Persians, would actually allow some of these people to stay around and function as consultants, as advisors. They would take advantage of their intellect and their skills. Daniel was one of them. And so let's enter the story. This is Daniel chapter 2, verse 1, and we're going to discover how Daniel relates to the wise men. He doesn't just relate to them. What you'll discover pretty quickly is he was one of them. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled, and he could not sleep. So this king summoned the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I have had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means." Now, to make an application, go to your favorite White House drama. So go to your television show, or whatever your favorite, you know, White House drama. Imagine the president, and then imagine all those surrounding him, and he needs answers. And what is he's going to his chief of counsel, he's going to key cabinet member, he's going to other people in the White House. Imagine that. And arguably maybe some of the politicians today would fit the category of sorcerers, enchanters, and astrologers. But he's essentially saying, "I need you to tap into your resources and find out what's going on. I needed you to do some research and development." The magicians were that. Of course, they did it through philosophy and science and education. And it could be argued later on in the story, when these magi come to find Jesus, they're working for a king, that he goes, hey, there are rumors, and this was true, at the birth of Jesus, there were rumors in the world at that time that the God out there was going to send a Messiah, like not just in the Jewish world, but beyond that. So there were these rumors, there was prophecies, that was very normal for the world at that time. And perhaps that the king said, hey, we need to do some research and development. We heard there's a king that may arrive somewhere out west, go on a trek and find out who he is. Are we threatened? You know, it could be argued that, and that could have been part of the story. Of course, what we know about these magi is that they respond uniquely once they come face to face with Jesus. But back here in this time of Daniel, this king has a dream. He presses in. He says, I want to know what the dream is. But his astrologers answer, verse 10, there's not a man on earth who can do what the king has asked. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. And he basically said, here's my dream, interpret it. But they're all saying, this is too difficult. It's too complex. No one knows the answer. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among men. Verse 12, this made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death. And men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death. Daniel, what we discover in the verses that follow, has a daily time of prayer with God. And in this daily download, God gives him insight. And so Daniel reaches out to the head of the death squad, who Daniel would have known. So here's the head of the secret service, whoever. Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king appointed to execute the wise men of Babylon, and said to him, do not execute the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king, and I will interpret the dream for him. I want to highlight this because it wouldn't have been lost on those around Daniel that he saved their lives. There would have been stories that were told by those families to their friends. Stories they would have passed on. It was a very oral culture. They would have passed along these stories to their children and to their grandchildren, their grandchildren's children. And on through the generations, there would have been the story of this man, Daniel, who stood on their behalf, whose God gave him information that protected them and allowed them to carry on their way of life through the centuries, both through the transition of Babylon into the conquering of Persia, because when Persia came along, they kept some of the wise men because they said, we'll take these men of intellect and use them now in our society. And on it went. And so here we have, generations later, these wise men who would have known the story, the Jewish story, all because of a man named Daniel who chose to stand for truth. And I just want to pause for a second here and go, if you have the moment when you think, is my life really that significant? How does one life touch the life of another? Now, granted, this is an extreme dramatic representation of that. But might I submit to each of us that your life impacts another in ways you can't possibly imagine? You don't know how your demeanor impacts your child, who will pass that on to his child, and who will pass that on to his child. The stories that you tell, the things that you value, the moments you gather and arrive in a building with other believers, call it the gathering of the church, and pause on a Sunday for a concentrated, intentional time of worship, and patterns that are developed, neural pathways in the minds of your children, and how they pass them on to their children, their children's children. And I just wanted to pull the lens out real quick, real wide, so that we don't forget that our lives impact the lives of others. These wise men, the first investors in Christianity, it could be argued, are here because of the life of Daniel. Sadly, those who were around the king, Jews, who had information, knowledge, and proximity, Bethlehem is very, very close to Jerusalem. They were clueless, unaware, blind. If they were looking for hope, they were looking for it in all the wrong places. And there would have been moments they were looking for hope because the king in this story, King Herod, was unstable, unpredictable. There was a tension that hung in the air. There would have been an anticipation if the rumor was out that perhaps salvation was coming. There would have been an anticipation that God would save them. But there would have also been this pressure that said, we don't really want to disrupt the king because we don't know what he'll do. He's too unpredictable. So sometimes I think, for a quick, again, application, we feel the anticipation of Christmas. There is this anticipation of what God might do, but there's also the pressure of going, my life might be disrupted, and I might rather just stay in my comfort. Herod emerges as the foil in the story. The foil is the contrast of the good. The protagonist in this story, of course, is Jesus. This is God's story. But the Magi right here, the camera turns on them. The spotlight's on them for a moment as we follow a bit of their journey. And King Herod emerges as the foil. You have the truly reigning king who's in a manger, this picture of humility and gentleness. And then you have this man who's threatened, jealous, unpredictable, unstable, full of hatred and anger. And of course, he's meant to be a personification of our own hearts. Because the truth is, we have a tendency to build our own kingdoms. We have a tendency to look out for ourselves and cut off people who threaten our little world. If the Bible teaches us anything, we learned that God displays himself in ways we don't expect. If we have complete control, which of course would be an illusion anyway, but if we think we have control and we're the full authority in our kingdom, then we will not see, we will be blind when God shows himself. God displayed himself to Mary and Joseph through a dream. He displayed himself to the shepherds through angelic warriors and an announcement in the sky. To the Magi, he shows himself through science and astronomy as they discover God in the stars. Here we had in these men people who had devoted their entire lives to research, and while certainly they would have been some of the wisest men on the planet, it appears that there is still an emptiness in their soul. Why? Well, because what we find at the manger, when they arrive and they see the child, there's immediately a response. There's a compulsion that happens within them. It's a compulsion to worship. We'll come back to this, but that action tells us something about who they are. Wise, full of knowledge, but there had to be this sense that there was something more, a belief, and a belief so sure that they left all that was comfortable to go out and pursue it. Another interesting thing about these men is that they didn't have their theology completely worked out. There's a good chance, as astrologers, that they would have had a mixture of pagan beliefs. So in the midst of their superstitions and incomplete science and false religions, they were still searching for truth. They knew something was missing. They just didn't know what. But they were searchers. It's interesting, I've had this contrast. I've sometimes run into people who would identify themselves as Christian, and the tone of their lives is, I'm right about everything, and why don't you come and be right with me? And when we're right together, we can convince the world how wrong it is. They're just not very enjoyable people. And then I run into people who might not even use the word Christian, but they would say, I'm a seeker of truth. I'm trying to find something. Something's missing. I'm not my own sustenance, and I'm trying to find, and I've heard lots of variations. I'm trying to find God. I'm trying to find truth. I'm trying to find something. And the thing that's always interesting for me is there's just a different sense of humility about this person. And I think this is what happens when Jesus shows up on the scene and the religious people, the Pharisees, say, we've got it all right. Here are the rules. Here are the laws. Follow us in this way. Ironically, they looked at Jesus as, this is just a man who is totally different than us. He's not following the rules. He's contradicting them. Jesus wasn't just searching the truth, however, he was the truth. Here we find in the Magi people humble enough to recognize they need something more. And more than humble, courageous enough to look. I don't know about you, but there are times I don't want to look. Times I don't want to search. Because I've discovered a few things about God. If I really, really seek truth, if I really seek him, and I really ask for what I need and for what I want, he might just give it to me. And I'm not sure it's exactly how I wanted it to happen. I remember having this prayer one time. God, I love our church, and we just want to walk in faith. God, let us never be comfortable. Just make sure we're trusting you. He answered that prayer. I was like, God, can I go back and take that prayer back? I'd like to be really comfortable, walk in certainty, stay in the factory. See, God is endlessly disruptive. And when you've lived with him long enough, you kind of learn to know that. But faith is trusting in his heart. It's believing that he is trustworthy. Recently, in my prayer time, especially the last 6 months, you know, so I don't know if you're like me. I have seasons where, as I'm interacting with God, there's certain aspects of his personality or certain names of God that kind of ring out. As I'm praying, you know, I've been through seasons where I just see him in such a holy light, and it feels like sacred ground, and really in that kind of kingly nature, and I just feel very small and in awe of God, maybe like the Magi would have when they would have walked up on this moment. And that had this kind of sense, not just of wonder, but of just this immense majesty. And then I have other moments where I'm interacting with God and it feels more like a father or like a friend, and it's informal. My last few months have been like that. So a lot of my prayers, I just kind of open up like, God, how are you? Good, how's Jesus? To which usually he's like, well, you could ask him. And okay, Jesus, how are you? And seriously, this is the tone of my prayers. I'm letting you into a little bit of how jacked up I am, maybe. So God and I have these conversations, and the last few months in particular, I just feel like I've heard God saying, so Jamie, what is it that you want? And I'm like, well, I mean, you and I have been talking about a Ferrari for about 30 years. Yes, we have. What is it that you really want? I'm like, I want health. And okay, well, what is it that you really want? And sometimes I feel like God's like the FBI. You know, they just keep asking the same question over and over again, and it's some kind of a trick. It's a device. And I'm like, what do I really want? My family. I just want us to, you know, have this sense of unity and oneness. And what is it you really want? Well, okay, maybe there's something else. And I don't know if you've had this experience. And I mean, God has just been. And what he's going after is, what are you searching for? What is it that in the core of your being you long for? And we've had some conversations about that. The Magi were searching for something. There was something in the deep part of them that they wanted. They actually wanted to give their worship to something. And I think what they discovered was it was someone. And they did. Did you catch that one line in the story that when the star finally stops and it appears over Bethlehem, here's the phrase, they were overjoyed. And most commentators say there's a whole lot locked into that word, that there it's like superlative upon superlative. It's this deep sense of joy, that there is a compulsion of adoration and awe. Their anticipation had the finishing moment. It was beyond their wildest dreams, everything they hoped for and more, that here they were, and this little boy was from not the gods, but from God himself. And he'd come to rescue the world. And at some level, they were understanding he'd come to rescue them, because there was in their posture and in their action this bowing to worship. Two compulsions when we're fully confronted with the person of Christ. First, we worship, and you can't not. Have you had that moment where you sensed the presence of God? God revealed himself to you in such a way. Perhaps you were watching a movie and you saw in a story and there was some deep validation of something and you went, yes, I get that. Or perhaps God answered a prayer for you in a way that was really meaningful. Or perhaps it was at the birth of your child. Or perhaps it was some other moment. And what happened? something came out of you. It was an expression of worship. Sometimes it's in a tear, it's in a chuckle, or it's in laughter, or it's in wide eyes. But something's happening and you're going, yes, there is something transcendent in this world. I recognize the spiritual thing that's at play. And I'm compelled to worship. There was a second response from the Magi, and that's that they gave something of value. They gave away something of value. And I think we have in this the great universal spiritual principle about all things. If you'll genuinely search, if you'll find the deep desire that God has placed in your heart, and he has, if nothing else, God set eternity in the hearts of men, there is within you a deep longing for God. Whether you're aware of it or whether you're giving attention to it. And then what its unique expression. You know, we long for God in different ways. But that's for each one of us. It's there. This longing for God. When we respond to that longing, we're always brought to confrontation. Will you then surrender and worship? And in that surrender, you have to give up something of value. Oh, this is a great spiritual principle. And it's recurring. What's the thing you're meant to give up? My family, we sold our house about 6-8 months ago, and almost everything in it. And if you would ask me 2 years ago, I would have went, well, no, the house and several things in it were things that I felt very attached to. I wasn't ready to let go of. When we sold everything, there was this letting go. Some of it was prying my hands open, but it was a letting go. And it wasn't just letting go of a house, it was letting go of a story. It was a massive shift in our lives, and we felt like it was the right decision for the right season. It's been actually really wonderful, but there's a letting go. We all have attachments to things, and when God calls to us and the desire comes up, we're confronted with, like Herod, do we want to go, nope, let's keep the world comfortable, let's not let anything change because I don't want to be disrupted, so I'm going to now protect my little kingdom. I feel threatened, actually, by the deep desire of God within me. Or, oh God, this desire is rising up. It is passionate and wild and deep. And I don't know what's at the end of it, which means I know you're calling me to faith. And what's the thing keeping me from it? Almost all of us can go, oh, that. If I do this, I'll feel financially insecure. If I do this, I might lose a relationship. If I do this, I might fill in the blank. When God calls us to a next season of faith, there's usually something to let go of. But here's the deal. In the search and the call and the response to that call, if you choose to surrender, that's where transformation happens. Go into your story. If you look at all the pivot points in your story, God called you to something and you gave something up, stepped into faith. Now, by the way, maybe you didn't give it up willingly. It was crisis, and it came and took it from you. I talked with a man in between services. He said, by the way, I died last week. I'm like, tell me a little more. He said, I died on Tuesday, had a heart attack in the middle of the night. My wife drove me 9 minutes. She got me to the emergency room. We pulled in. The police were chasing her the entire way. We pulled into the emergency room. They were... I'm going to change the language a little bit. They were not kind to her and about her speeding, and while they were yelling at her, he flatlined. They put the paddles on him twice, and the doctor said, let's give it one more shot. They revved the thing up, and on the third time, he came back. He said, so it's really good to be in church today. He said, God's been telling me to slow down for some time. I've slowed down. But there's an example. I've said this before, whether you jump off the cliff in faith or get kicked off the cliff, one way or another, God in his love is going to push us past ourselves. He's going to separate us from the things that are attachments. The other word for that is idolatry. There's something in your life that's really good, it's really beneficial, and it's an idol because you've given it too much energy. Too much worth. God is endlessly going, wait a second, I've got to pry your hands off that because you can't see me when you start to make that your idol. So what are you searching for this morning? I mean, what do you really want? Down deep, what is the desire that God has placed in your soul? You know, the closer you get, the clearer the picture. The treasure we seek, eventually, we find. God pours out his grace upon us. He invites us to the King. So what a value will you lay down? Will it be leftovers, or will it be your finest gift? Will you step forward in trust and in faith, or in the interface of that decision, will you draw back and stay blind? We are all called to our own path, our own journey. It's unique and special, and no one can take that journey for you. Do you remember what Herod said to the Magi? Hey, go and tell me about it. Sometimes we wish other people would go do the work. I can't do the work for you. If you're in a village, your village guide can't do the work for you. Your spouse, they can't fill the void in your soul. You have to search. You have to seek first the kingdom of God on your own. And then all these things will be added unto you. Would you bow your heads and close your eyes with me? Let's go to a space of contemplation and reflection for a moment. I want to give you a little space to think about this. Consider it. Whatever it is for you, just stare at the floor, close your eyes. I want to give you this question and just, there's no rush. Just be in it for a moment. What is it that you want? What do you want? And if something's coming to mind, like I'd like some financial relief, I'd like this relationship to work out, I'd like some physical release. Underneath that, okay, but why? Why do you want to be physically whole? Why do you want this relationship to work? Why do you want financial relief? Why do you wish this happened in your career? What is it that deep down you really, really want? What are you searching for? All right. For those of you that found it, what's in the way? What are you clinging to? God, if you're revealing any of this now, in this moment here, in this space, would you bring some clarity to those who are right now searching? God, would you bring clarity to what it is that gets in the way? Is there a thing we've turned into an idol? Is there an attachment that has us stuck? And then, Father, would you empower us with the courage to surrender it back to you? In your teachings, you said, unless we hate our father, our mother, sister, or brother, it seems like such a contradiction. We're called to love, but understanding that you're saying, unless we let go of the things we're attached to, that we think we can control, we will have trouble walking in faith. God, would you just reveal what's in the way? And would you meet us in a place of surrender this morning, that you would find us like those magi, bowing in worship, acknowledging you're trustworthy, and giving you that thing of value, that thing we hold dear. Would this Christmas be not just a celebration of your birth, but a celebration of our letting go and surrendering? And then we get to have moments where we step back and watch the transformation. Thank you for the way you come to us, not as an angry Greek god, but as a gentle, kind, loving father. So you've called us to worship. God, we've gathered together with some intention this morning, and that's to say back, pray, to sing about how much we love you, to remember some of the stories of the season and how they reflect your love, to sing about the stories, and then just to sing just to you, God, to tell you how much we love you, and let the very act of praise be an act of surrender. Would you receive now our act of worship? In Jesus' name, amen.